Well, where did I leave off? Transport proteins? Is that what I was talking about? Okay, yeah. Hormones is another way that proteins work. Now, hormones are signals. We've talked about signals before. Any given chemical signal has an effect only if it binds to a receptor somewhere. Well, there's various hormones in your body, for instance. Some of them are lipid-based, but most of them are protein-based. So proteins can act as the signals themselves. But then a totally different job is to act as receptors. Receptors are always proteins. Hormones sometimes are proteins, sometimes aren't. But regardless of what the hormone is, the receptor is a protein. And this just is another good example of what I've said already, namely that whatever a function is that a protein has, it has that function because of its specific shape. Well, receptors have to be shaped just right in order to receive the specific kind of signal that they're specific for. Then you have contractile and motor proteins. Actin and myosin are proteins that make up your muscles. Muscles get shorter because of interaction between these two types of protein. And when muscles get shorter, they pull on bones or contract spaces and make things move. And then you have defensive proteins, which are important in your immune system. Antibodies are proteins. They're produced, there's many, many thousands of different kinds of antibodies that can be produced. Each one is specific because of its shape for one specific kind of potential invader. This is the basis for vaccination. Vaccination introduces into your body some antigen, and if you have just randomly made an antibody that is specific for that invading antigen, then your body will be spurred on to making a hell of a lot more copies of that kind of antibody, and therefore you'll have immunity if you get exposed again. So this is a hugely diverse set of functions that proteins have. Now, any individual protein has a specific function, so it's not that a protein can do any of these. It takes different kinds of proteins to do these different jobs. But the reason that proteins, compared to the other three categories of macromolecules, have such a wide diversity of functions is because there's really no limit to the number of shapes that proteins can take on. If you were designing them, for instance, in a lab, you could have a protein have just about any shape you want. Well, in 16, this is just one specific example of why shape is important. And it's a specific example of function. The first one on the previous list was enzymes. It's a big fraction of your body's proteins are specifically functioning as enzymes, which are catalysts that speed up reactions. Well, they do this by temporarily binding to a reactant, in this example, sucrose, table sugar. And to be able to do that, the enzyme, which is the protein, the purple thing, has to have the right shape to fit that substrate. And when that happens, that binding of the substrate to the enzyme, the reaction is accelerated. In this case, the reaction is a splitting of sucrose into its constituent monosaccharides, which is what kind of reaction, by the way? Hydrolysis, splitting bigger things into smaller things. But whether it's an enzyme or not, the point is proteins function the way they do because of their shape. Well, we haven't looked at any proteins yet, and we still haven't in slide 17, because this is not a protein. It's not big enough to be a protein, because a protein is a polymer. Remember that three of the four categories of macromolecules are officially polymers. What are those three, by the way? Proteins,
nucleic acids,
and polysaccharides. Now, if you use the alternative words for them, it's obvious which ones are polymers. Polysaccharides is already obvious. What's another name for nucleic acids? Polynucleotides. That tells you it's a polymer. And for proteins, polypeptides. Well, that's what we're looking at in this section of the chapter. But this is not a polypeptide. This is just one subunit that you can use to make a polypeptide. Polypeptides are polymers, just like polysaccharides and polynucleotides are. But the subunits that you use, the monomers that you stick together to make proteins or polypeptides, is different from the monomers that you use to make polysaccharides. For polysaccharides, you hook together monomers called monosaccharides. For polypeptides, you hook together monomers that are called amino acids. And this is the general scheme for how an amino acid is arranged atomically. Now, notice that there is no element on the periodic table symbolized with R. So just like R in functional groups means residue, meaning anything, the rest of the molecule, that's what R means here. It is a variable. But as long as you have everything else in place, R can be anything you want, and this will be an amino acid. An amino acid is called an amino acid because to be an amino acid, it has to have an amino group, that's the amino part of the word, of course, and it also has to have a carboxyl group. Things that have a carboxyl group, remember, are called carboxylic acids. So it's an amino acid. You have a central carbon, the magenta C. That, of course, has to have four bonds, but in this case it's four single bonds, one of which is made with a carboxyl, one of which is made with a hydrogen, one of which is made with an amino group, and then the fourth can be anything you want. As long as all the rest of this is like it is here, then that is that's an amino acid. So since R can be anything you want, and not just a single atom, it can be any group of atoms, that should tell you that there is no limit to the number of possible amino acids, right? As long as you have all of this right, you can have any collection of atoms for R and it will be an amino acid. The simplest possibility would just be have another hydrogen here. But there's no limit, right? Because it can be a group, not just a single atom. So there is no limit to the number of amino acids, but when it comes to biology, organisms use the same set of just 20 amino acids. And therefore, some books will say there are 20 amino acids. That's nonsense. There's no limit, as I just told you. But there are 20 biological amino acids. Because all organisms in the world, not just present, but past as well, use the same set of 20. This is just one of several bits of strong evidence pointing to the fact that all organisms stem from one ancestor, the original successful cell lineage that I keep talking about. That's why we all use the same set of 20, even though there's many more possible. All right, so that's just what makes something an amino acid. I just told you there are 20 biological amino acids, and slide 18 shows you a listing of all 20 of those. Notice that every one of these shares that framework that makes it an amino acid. Each one has a central carbon with an amino, a hydrogen, and a carboxyl, and then something else. Therefore, the only variable part, the only reason that there are different amino acids is because of that R group. And that's what's highlighted in white in each of these. That's the only thing that makes these different from each other. Well, the 20 biological amino acids are then grouped, as you see here with the periwinkle shading, based on the chemistry of their R groups. So there are nonpolar amino acids because the R group in almost all of these cases is hydrocarbon. Hydrocarbons in general are nonpolar because carbon and hydrogen have the same electronegativity and therefore there's equal sharing. That's what makes them nonpolar. On the other hand, you have a group of amino acids, biological amino acids, that are polar because their R group is polar. The easiest way to become polar is to have either oxygen or sulfur, which have high electronegativities, bonded to an oxygen. Just like in water, an OH bond is polar, right? Well, if you have an OH bond in an R group of an amino acid, then the amino acid is polar. And then the third group is actually beyond polar. Polar is partially charged because of unequal sharing. But in the bottom group, you have electrically charged. In other words, the R group is ionized. And that's a full charge, even beyond polar. So you really could subdivide the electrically charged group into two subgroups based on whether it's a positive charge or a negative charge. The positive charges make the R group basic or alkaline, and the negative charges make them acidic. The reason this is biologically important, this grouping, is because the protein shape means everything, as I just was telling you. And if the protein doesn't have that shape, it won't do that function, whatever it is. Well, what makes a protein have a shape is the relationship between the R groups of amino acids in the overall protein. You assemble a protein or a polypeptide, one amino acid at a time, sticking them together. So you can think of it as building a string of beads. It's just, you know, at first just a line of beads lined up. But they don't stay lined up. They fold up into three-dimensional shape based on how the R groups that are hanging off of these beads interact with each other chemically, whether they're polar or nonpolar. We'll talk more about that with a different slide. First, though, let's talk about the actual building of the polymer. An amino acid is just a monomer. You have to hook together amino acids to make a polypeptide. And doing that means you're going to be turning smaller things into bigger things, right? Which is what kind of reaction? Dehydration. Or condensation, but dehydration is the better word because it reminds you of the fact that water comes out of that situation, right? One of the smaller pieces gets stripped of an OH, the other gets stripped of an H. Together those make water, but that allows you to sew together with a covalent bond the two smaller pieces. In this case, the smaller pieces are amino acids. Now, every amino acid individually has a carboxyl end and an amino end because of what I told you it means to be an amino acid, right? Importantly, the only way to hook together amino acids to make a polypeptide is to make the connection between the carboxyl group of one amino acid and the amino group of the other amino acid. Now compare this in your mind, knowing what you've already been taught about polysaccharides, compare this to hooking together monosaccharides, which, remember, monosaccharides to be hooked together have to be in the ringed form, remember? But when they're in the ringed form, there's more than one connection point because there's a lot of H's and OH's on monosaccharides. And so there isn't just one way to hook them together, and that's why a polysaccharide can be branched, because there can be multiple connection points on the same monosaccharide that can be hooked to different monosaccharides. Glycogen, I gave you an example, as a storage polysaccharide that we make. It is highly branched. Polysaccharides can be branched. They don't have to be, but they can be, because monosaccharides have multiple connection points possible for dehydration reactions. That's not true, though, for amino acids. And therefore, a polypeptide cannot branch. It is a single end-to-end arrangement. This is why we use beads on a string as an analogy. Beads on a string don't branch. It's one string. And there's just a specific order of beads within that string. Okay, so it's always the amino group of one amino acid being connected via a dehydration reaction to the carboxyl group of the other amino acid. And therefore, when you string them together, however many amino acids long it is, the entire polypeptide also has a carboxyl end and an amino end. Okay, it's not, that's not true of just single amino acids, it's true of polypeptides as well. Well, in polysaccharides, remember that the process of dehydration reaction resulted in a bond that we named. There was a specific name for the bond between two monosaccharides. What was that? You were all here. What is the name of the specific bond formed between two monosaccharides? Yes. Glycosidic linkages are formed because of dehydration, but we only call it a glycosidic linkage if the two things linked are monosaccharides. Here we have dehydration linking two different kinds of monomers. These are not monosaccharides, they're amino acids. And once again, we give that a special name, which is a peptide bond. And similarly, when we were talking about fats, the bond between a fatty acid and the glycerol was a ester linkage. All of these specific bonds get names, even though they all result from the same process, dehydration reaction. Okay, so peptide bond is the name of the bond, not the monomer. The monomers are amino acid. When you make several peptide bonds, though, because you hook multiple amino acids together, that's why that resulting polymer is called a polypeptide. In this case, we name the word after the bonds, not the monomers. In polysaccharide, we name it after the monomers, right? Monosaccharides hooked together. Anyway, that's why the words make sense. Now, a very important thing about the bottom part of this slide is that bond, the peptide bond between the carboxyl of one and the amino of the next amino acid, is the only thing that holds the polypeptide together along its length. Okay, the peptide bonds hold the thing together. The R group, the variable part of each amino acid, is not at all involved in holding it together. These are three R groups for these particular amino acids that have been linked. Notice that they're just hanging off of each bead. They're not connected to each other, and so they're not holding it together. But those R groups, even though they don't hold the polypeptide together, those are going to be important in determining what three-dimensional shape the polypeptide assumes once it's built by the cell. All right, now to 20. This is just two different ways that we can depict or represent polypeptides. Each of these is a single polypeptide. It's the same polypeptide, just shown two different ways. Space-filling models are easy to do with computers nowadays, but they don't really give you all that much information, really. Ribbon models are nice, not because they really show what the molecule looks like, because it reminds you of the important fact that a single polypeptide is a non-branching end-to-end arrangement of some number of amino acids. So just like a ribbon has exactly two ends and no branches, so does any polypeptide. But notice it's not just stretched out. It has a specific shape. And it doesn't matter what this example is, that would be true of any polypeptide. These yellow things, don't worry about those now. I'll talk about those in a different slide. But notice this is one continuous ribbon. It has two ends, a carboxyl end and an amino end at the other end. But it's made up of many amino acids. 21 is just another example. Here we have two different proteins. One from an organism, a human, for instance, an antibody. This is the immunity aspect I was talking about. So the reason this antibody works is because it has just the right shape to recognize this other protein that is not from an organism. It's a flu virus. Viruses are not organisms, but it's a protein that fits right into the other protein that the human makes, and therefore there's a recognition. This is why you need different kinds of antibodies. Each one is specific for a different antigen, the thing that's being recognized. Another example of how shape is so important to protein function. Now in 22, we need to talk about the four levels of protein structure. And these are named primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary, as you see. These are just words that mean first, second, third, and fourth. Up to now, I have been using the words polypeptide and protein more or less interchangeably. Sometimes they can be used interchangeably, but not always. And so now I'm finally getting around to telling you how they can be different. Okay, that'll be part of this slide. Every protein features at least the first three of these levels of structure. Every protein has a primary structure, a secondary structure, and a tertiary structure. Only some proteins, in addition to having those first three levels, have the fourth level of structure, the quaternary structure. Okay, so this will make more sense after once we get up there, but let's go in order. Primary structure refers simply to the specific sequence of amino acids in a single polypeptide. So represented here as a string of beads is one polypeptide. The two important bits of information that make up primary structure is how many amino acids long it is and which specific one of the 20 amino acids occupies each of the positions. So if you think of it as being a string of beads, constructing the string of beads means you're using a kit of beads of which there are 20 different types. You have an unlimited number of each type, but when you string them together, you have to choose for each position one of the 20. And you don't have to know these three-letter abbreviations, but they're just abbreviations for the biological amino acids. Glycine, proline, threonine, and so on. Okay, so how long the sequence is and what the specific sequence is of amino acids, that is primary structure. Primary structure, whatever it is so important because it will determine all the higher levels of structure. In other words, secondary and tertiary structure, quaternary structure, exists as a consequence of primary structure. Okay, secondary structure refers to whether or not the polypeptide includes any of these repeating patterns that are seen in a lot of polypeptides, but not all. One of the two repeating patterns that's seen a lot are so-called beta-pleated sheets, pleated like an accordion. So they fold up, like you see here. Some proteins have them, some don't. But if it does, that's part of secondary structure and how many there are. The other kind is an alpha helix. A protein can have both or neither or just one. A helix is a corkscrew shape, though, and you see this in a lot of proteins as well. So secondary structure isn't the overall three-dimensional shape of the polypeptide. It just has to do with these often repeating motifs. All right, tertiary structure is the overall three-dimensional shape of a single polypeptide. So in ribbon representation, tertiary structure is a single ribbon, as you see here. This is just one polypeptide. But the way that it folds up into three dimension, its overall three-dimensional shape, that's the tertiary structure. So now that should explain what I said before, namely that every protein has at least these first three levels. Because every protein consists of at least one polypeptide. Now, some proteins are made up of just one polypeptide. That's all there is in the protein, is one polypeptide. And that's the case in which the two words are interchangeable. If a protein is made up of just one polypeptide, then polypeptide and protein refer to the same thing. But there are some proteins made up of multiple polypeptides, either two or more of the same polypeptide, but different copies of it, or two or more different kinds of polypeptides. Those are more complex proteins because they are made out of multiple polypeptides, and we call such proteins multimeric. That's going to be way too light. Multimeric is really, even though it's a different word, it's kind of the same word as polymer. Multimer and polymer really mean about the same thing. Multi and poly both mean many, right? And mer means part. Well, we're already using the word polymer to refer to the individual polypeptide. It's already a polymer, right? A multimeric protein is multiple polymers because each of the individual polypeptides that make up that multimeric protein is already a polymer. Therefore, the overall protein is a multimeric protein. Well, only multimeric proteins, only ones that are made up of two or more polypeptides, have quaternary structure. And the quaternary structure is the specific three-dimensional arrangement of the constituent multiple polypeptides making up that multimeric protein. We see that here looks like there's four different polypeptides in this particular example. And like I said, it doesn't matter whether it's four copies of the same one or four different ones or two of one and two of another. The fact is there's more than one polypeptide here. Each purple glob is one polypeptide, one ribbon. But there's multiple ones that are held together somehow, and that's what makes it a multimeric protein. Importantly, a multimeric protein is not made by stringing together multiple polypeptides end to end. If you did that, you would just be making a bigger single polypeptide, right? So each of the individual polypeptides in a multimeric protein remain individual polypeptides. Each one has two ends, one ribbon. But the ribbons are held together somehow in a multimeric protein. And therefore, in those multimeric proteins, there's all four levels. But any protein that is just one polypeptide big has only the first three levels. Okay, 23. Here we're looking at the attractive forces that can occur between R groups of amino acids that are in a polypeptide. And these attractive forces occur between R groups of non-adjacent amino acids. Adjacent amino acids, that means they're next to each other. Two beads right next to each other on the string. Those R groups are not going to interact. They're too close together. But if you imagine actually making a bead of strings, after you build it, if you bend the string of beads, you can bring non-adjacent beads, ones that aren't next to each other in the string, close to each other by bending it. And that's what happens with amino acids in a polypeptide. And the R groups that those amino acids are carrying might want to interact chemically, depending on what group they belong to, whether they're polar or nonpolar, so on. So we see here four different major interactions between R groups of non-adjacent amino acids. The ribbon, the purple part, just represents the chain of amino acids. That's the detail isn't shown, but what's holding that together is the amino and the carboxyl groups binding with peptide bonds. And not all of the R groups are shown here, just some of them that happen to be somewhere in the position, and when you bend it, it brings those two R groups together. Well, first up, and there's no order to these, but the one on the upper left is, well, the first possibility is hydrogen bonding, which you should already know forms if you have two polar things next to each other, just like two water molecules form a hydrogen bond between them because each one is polar. Well, if you have two R groups that are polar come close to each other, there's going to be a slight attraction between them because of hydrogen bonding. The OH here and the O here, for instance. Well, you know that that's not a chemical bond, but it's because it's weaker than even an ionic bond. It doesn't make new stuff. But it's, even though it's much weaker, it's still more than zero. And that's going to influence how the polypeptide folds. This is why a polypeptide has the shape that it does, because of the interactions that we're looking at. So that's one possibility, hydrogen bonding. Up here we have hydrophobic interactions. It's a little bit harder to understand because notice hydrophobic interactions, as the name indicates, involves nonpolar R groups. Remember that hydrophobic and nonpolar go hand in hand. Hydrophobic things are nonpolar, which is why they don't like to be around water, which is why they're called hydrophobic. Okay? So notice, you should know even without the label that these are hydrophobic R groups because they are hydrocarbon R groups, right? Just C's and H's. And back when we originally talked about hydrocarbons and polarity, I told you that nonpolar things are not attracted to each other, like two oxygen molecules just bounce off of each other, right? Because they're not polar. So how is it that two nonpolar R groups form an attraction? And that's the part that's a little bit harder to understand. This is even less of an attractive force than a hydrogen bond, which is already slight, but it's still better than nothing. I'm just going to simplify it and show you just one. Damn, didn't I just change this? I'm going to show you one CH on one R group and another CH on another one. These are nonpolar, right? But that means, they are still covalent bonds, and they're therefore sharing, they're being shared by the C and the H. And similarly, it's a pair of electrons being shared by this C and H. So since they're being shared, those electrons are, at any given moment, near either the C or the H. They can't be in two places at once. Follow me on that? So if they happen to start moving in unison, the pairs of electrons, so that at the same moment that they're at the carbon on this top one, the ones below are at the hydrogen, then this is going to be very, for just for a tiny fraction of a second, slightly negative, and this is going to be slightly positive. And then the next moment they'll shift together, so that now the hydrogen has the electrons and this carbon has the electrons, and they're once again going to be oppositely charged from each other. And as long as they move like that, which they can do, then there will be a slight attraction between the two nonpolar groups. That's called a hydrophobic interaction. And very slight individually, but you can have a lot of those building up. This is, for instance, why a gecko can walk upside down on a glass ceiling, because of hydrophobic interactions between its feet and the glass. So it makes a big deal when it comes to structure of the protein. These are real forces, in other words. Those two are comparatively weak, though. In yellow, we have what's called a disulfide bridge. And this is exactly what those yellow marks were in the previous, or in the earlier slide when I said I would explain it later. Those represented disulfide bridges. Disulfide means there's two sulfurs involved. Well, if you look at the table of all the 20 biological amino acids that we did earlier, you'll notice that one of those has sulfur in it in the form of a sulfhydryl group. It's cysteine is the name of the amino acid that has sulfur, but most of the amino acids don't have any sulfur. Cysteine, though, has sulfhydryl. And what is sulfhydryl?
Sulfur and hydrogen.
Right. It's just like a hydroxyl except SH instead of OH. So if you have a cysteine here with its sulfhydryl and a cysteine here that are coming near each other with its own sulfhydryl, what happens is that each sulfhydryl loses its hydrogen. And that allows the two S's to be covalently bonded to replace that bond that they had with hydrogens. And so that's a covalent bond, and that is particularly strong, therefore. And so disulfide bridges really stabilize the shape of the protein, locking it into that shape. You don't see these in all proteins, but some proteins have a lot of these, like your hair, stabilizing the shape, making it strong, and that's why hair, burning hair, smells like sulfur. And then finally, in this, I don't know why they thought they had to reuse blue, but down here, the lower blue is an ionic bond that can form. Remember, I said that the ionic group of amino acids can be subdivided into the positively charged ones and the negatively charged ones. So if you have a positive one and a negative one come together, just like a sodium and a chloride are going to be attracted, so are these to form an ionic bond. And that's not as strong as a covalent, but it's stronger than these top two. So that also is important in stabilizing the structure. Well, the secondary structure is a specific kinds of bends. And it usually involves a pattern of amino acids that's repeated several times in order to make either the alpha helix. The alpha helix is not the entire length of it. It's the overall ribbon has a shape, but in that shape of the ribbon, you'll have parts that are helices and parts that are these pleated sheets. That's the sheets, pleated sheets, and these helices make up the secondary structure, which is just part of the overall shape. The overall shape of the single polypeptide is the tertiary structure. Okay, 24. These are just two examples of proteins, but they make the point that any given protein, of which there's no limit to, really, can be grouped into one of two categories based on its overall shape, basically. There are what we call fibrous proteins. Collagen's an example of that. Fibrous proteins are so-called because they form fibers. They are long and narrow. So they form little rope-like structures. Collagen's really strong. It resists being stretched. Tensile forces are resisted by collagen. It's important in your skin, for instance. You have a lot of collagen in your skin. Anyway, it's a fibrous protein. There's a lot of ones that are elongated. And fibrous proteins in general are structural proteins. Their job is to form some sort of structure. The other major category, which includes a lot of different proteins, is globular proteins, which simply means they are not especially long in one dimension. They're more compact. They don't have to be perfectly spherical or anything like that. They're compact. And hemoglobin's an example of that. Now, the examples here don't really matter, but when we're looking at these examples, notice that collagen is a multimeric protein. It's fibrous, but it also happens to be multimeric. Because this is one collagen, but it's made up of three individual polypeptides. And in this case, they happen to be three identical copies. But as long as it's more than one overall polypeptide, then it's multimeric. Hemoglobin is also multimeric. It's made up of four overall polypeptides, but in this case it's two copies of one type and two copies of another type. Well, speaking of hemoglobin, slide 25 features hemoglobin as an example. The main point of this, though, is not so much about hemoglobin specifically as it is about how important primary structure is to protein function. I said a little bit earlier when we were on the levels of protein structure slide that all of the higher levels, secondary and above, are a consequence of primary structure. So what that sequence is, which is what the primary structure is, determines all the other levels of structure, all the shapes. And you can see this really well with this hemoglobin example. Hemoglobin is, like I showed you in the previous slide, made up of four polypeptides, but two types. And therefore, it really takes two different genes to specify the two types of polypeptides. We'll worry about that later. Here we're not even talking about genes, but each polypeptide type is a specific sequence of amino acids. And it's much longer than seven amino acids, but just the first seven are shown here. That's why it kind of fades off. Okay? So on the left we have normal hemoglobin, what most people have. And that by normal I mean that it has a specific sequence that allows it to have a specific shape that allows it to function for what hemoglobin is supposed to do, which is to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide molecules. Picks up oxygen from the lungs, carries it to the cells of the body, picks up carbon dioxide from the cells of the body, brings it to the lungs to get rid of it. Hemoglobin does that, but only if it's the right shape. And it has the right shape if the first seven amino acids are specifically this, valine, histidine, leucine, and so on. Don't memorize the names. It's just the order is important. Okay, now there are many more than seven. The rest of them just aren't shown. On the right, we have hemoglobin, a mutant form that would be found in a human with sickle cell disease. And notice that there is only one difference. All of the amino acids, even beyond seven, are exactly the same as in a normal person, except one. Only this sixth bead is different. It's supposed to be glutamic acid, instead it's valine. One bead wrong in the string. But that means it has a different R group, and therefore it folds up differently in three-dimensional shape and doesn't do the same job. Not only does the misshapen protein, or polypeptide I should say, mean that the hemoglobin is not going to do the job of carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide, which is why it's such a bad disease, but it also causes individual hemoglobins to clump together with other hemoglobins. One red blood cell is carrying millions of copies of hemoglobin, and those millions of hemoglobins are not supposed to clump together like they do here. And that's another reason why it's so bad. So this is why primary structure is so important. If you want to use a linguistic analogy of why order is important, you can, instead of using sequences of amino acids, you can use sequences of words. For instance, the sentence, "What on earth are you doing?" means a certain thing, right? Well, you can use exactly the right words, but if you get the order wrong and say, "What are you doing on earth?" that has a totally different meaning, right? So order really matters. Okay, 26. More about the importance of shape. Any given protein, as I said, operates because of its specific shape. And therefore, anything that changes that shape can be very detrimental. I haven't told you yet, and probably should have earlier, that we usually use a different word other than shape to refer to the shape of a protein, even though it really means the same thing. When we talk about the shape of a protein, we call it its conformation. And the conformation can change. First of all, the protein has the shape it does primarily because of the sequences that we've just been talking about. That's what determines how it can fold up and have the R groups interact. But that can be influenced by the environment that it's in, the variables in that environment. And two biggies that I mentioned in a previous chapter that can really affect the shape of proteins or the conformation are pH and temperature. And I mentioned this first when we were talking about acid precipitation, when I showed you the sick forest. Well, pH, you don't have to change the pH or the temperature very much from what it's supposed to be for there to be a pretty major change in the structure and in the shape of the protein or the conformation. And if you change the conformation even a little bit, the function is at least going to be changed. It's not going to work as well. It might still do the job, but half-assed. If you drastically change the shape, then it's going to totally lose its function. And that's a major change in major loss of shape is called denaturation. Now, if whatever variables in the environment changed so that it got denatured, if it's not too drastic, a denaturation, as long as you restore those variables to what they should be, then you might have gotten away with it and there can be renaturation. It'll go back into its correct shape just for the same reason it got that shape to begin with, because of the relationships between the R groups. But if you go too far and you totally denature it, then that individual protein is now worthless. It's never going to function again. And the cell will just break it down into individual amino acids and recycle them to be used in some other protein that it can build. Now, that doesn't mean that the cell dies necessarily, because the cell can always make another copy of that protein. That's what genes are. Genes are the manuals for how to build the various polypeptides. That one's done if it's denatured, but you can start over and build a brand new one. A good example of this denaturation, though, is seen in cooking. And if you are a meat eater, if you think of a steak, the texture drastically changes when you cook it, right? It's a change in temperature causing a drastic change in conformation of the proteins, which steak is mostly made of. Well, if you change your mind and say, "I actually didn't want this steak," you can't just let it cool down and it's not going to turn into a raw steak again. That's a permanent denaturation. But also notice that, especially with raw fish, without cooking it, you can kind of get it into a cooked texture by squirting it with lemon juice, right, which is acidic. You change the pH and you also change the conformation of the proteins. All right, now to 27. This is kind of interesting that some proteins, or I should say polypeptides, because what the cell builds individually are polypeptides. Whether those polypeptides come together in multimeric proteins is another thing. But a cell builds individual polypeptides according to the instructions in genes. And for a lot of polypeptides, once they are built, once the string of beads is complete, it will fold up into the correct shape more or less on its own in the right there in the cell, in the main compartment of the cell, the cytosol. But there are some proteins or polypeptides that won't do this properly on their own. They have to be kind of sequestered away from everything else around them so that they have the proper environment to get the correct shape. And so this is one polypeptide that's trying to get its correct shape. That involves using a different polypeptide, another protein, called a chaperonin or a chaperone protein that more or less forms a little canister. So the chaperone protein is the canister. It has a hollow interior. The brand new, not yet folded polypeptide gets put into the hollow interior, so it's away from the rest of the components of the cell. That gives it the right environment for it to properly fold up into three dimensions, and then it's released. So it's one protein helping another protein have its shape, have the correct shape. Okay, now to 28, which is kind of a cusp slide, by which I mean this serves as the end of protein section, and it's also the beginning of the nucleic acid section. That's the only kind of macromolecule we haven't talked about yet. But this slide is about both, because it shows you the relationship between genes, which are made of DNA, which is a nucleic acid, and proteins that I've mentioned before. But I've said already several times that even though we say that genes give organisms their traits, that's only indirect. What directly gives an organism its traits are proteins. But while there's no limit to the number of proteins that could be built, no cell is able to build any kind of protein unless it is explicitly told how to do so. It has to be told the sequence. And that's the job, indirectly, of a gene. A gene is a nucleic acid that stores information in its sequence that we'll talk about in a minute, that is used in a process called... Well, actually, let me pause here and just quiz you. It probably seems like a long time ago already, but in the first week of the course, I said that there are two major jobs that DNA has in organisms. Do you remember what these are? No? Translation does not involve DNA. But transcription is one of the two.
Self-replication?
Yes, self-replication, exactly. That's what DNA does. It gets transcribed and it gets replicated. Here we're looking at transcription. Transcription of a gene, which is a DNA sequence, is a way for the cell to use the information that's in DNA to construct, which is a nucleic acid. DNA is a nucleic acid. And it uses that code to build another kind of nucleic acid, RNA, specifically in the form of mRNA, as you see here, the red ribbon. Okay? At that point, DNA's job is done. But without the DNA there, you can't make the RNA. The RNA is now holding a code of its own. And that RNA then goes out in the cell and finds a ribosome, which is a tiny organelle, that can read the mRNA. And using that code in the mRNA, it tells the ribosome what the primary structure is, what the sequence of amino acids is to hook together end to end to form this purple string of beads, the polypeptide. Well, it's the polypeptide that gives the organism its trait, but the cell wouldn't be able to build it without the gene originally, and that's why genes indirectly give us our traits. And that's why, even though there's no limit to the number of proteins that could be made in your cells, you're only ever going to be able to make the cells the DNA you're stuck with tells your cells to make. Okay? All right, so this overall process of protein synthesis, the making of a protein, is something we'll study in detail later, but it's a two-part thing, transcription and then translation. The translation part is when the polypeptide actually gets built. So that's the end of proteins and the beginning of nucleic acids. Let's go to 29. And in 29, we're seeing a polynucleotide on the left edge, notice. Now, you can more or less, well, almost. It's not exactly true that polynucleotide and nucleic acid are interchangeable words. Almost, though. What I mean here, it's very similar to why proteins and polypeptides aren't always the same thing. One polynucleotide, as the name indicates, is a sequence of monomers called nucleotides that have been hooked together. And that's what you see here. This isn't a very long string. There's only four nucleotides that have been connected here. In a DNA molecule, there are millions of nucleotides in the one overall polymer. So this is not a very big polynucleotide, but it's more than one, so it's a polynucleotide. Okay. That brings up the question of, though, what a nucleotide is. Nucleotides are the monomers that are hooked together to form nucleic acids or polynucleotides. We see a nucleotide in detail in the center here. Well, even though a nucleotide is a single subunit, it's a monomer, that nucleotide itself is made up of three smaller things. So to be a nucleotide, you have to have these three components. First of all, you have to have a sugar, but not just any sugar. It is a pentose sugar. And remember, that means it's a sugar with five carbons. That's what pentose means. And even more specifically, it's not just any pentose. It's one of two choices shown in the lower right. The pentose sugar of any nucleotide is going to be either deoxyribose, shown here in blue, or ribose, shown in red text. Let's take a couple seconds to compare the structural formulae. Look how similar they are. They're almost identical. The only difference is that ribose at the hydroxyl on position 2 here, that's where the second carbon is. This is carbon 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 5. This hydroxyl, of course, a hydroxyl is going to have an oxygen. There's an oxygen here on this second carbon. There isn't in deoxyribose. And that's why it's called deoxyribose. This is exactly like ribose, except without one of its oxygens. So it's deoxy, without oxygen, ribose. All right? So a nucleotide is going to have a sugar, but it's either deoxyribose or it's ribose. If it's ribose, then that's going to be an RNA nucleotide. If it's deoxyribose, that's going to be a DNA nucleotide. That's one component of the nucleotide, and then the other two components are both connected to that sugar, but in different places. One thing that needs to be connected to the sugar in order to make this whole thing a nucleotide is a phosphate group. At least one or more. In this case, it's one. And then the third component of the nucleotide is also connected to the sugar, but the opposite side. It's a nitrogenous base of some sort. Nitrogenous simply means nitrogen containing. Okay, now another thing about the sugars real quick before we go on. If you're building a DNA polynucleotide, which is many nucleotides long, every one of the nucleotides will have deoxyribose as the sugar. So there is no variability with respect to sugar within DNA. And similarly, if you're making an RNA polynucleotide, every one of the nucleotides is going to have ribose as the sugar. Okay, so within DNA, for instance, there aren't different nucleotides because of the sugar. There's only one sugar choice. And, as you already know, all phosphate groups are the same. So the phosphate doesn't make different kinds of nucleotides either. The only thing that's variable here that makes for different kinds of nucleotides is the nitrogenous base. Just like the only reason amino acids can differ is because of the R group. And notice on the upper right that there are 5 normally used nitrogenous bases in nucleic acids in general. But DNA uses 4 of these 5, and RNA uses 4 of these 5, but they're not the same 4. If you're building a DNA, which would mean you're using deoxyribose as the sugar, then the nitrogenous base is either cytosine, thymine, adenine, or guanine. If you're building an RNA, then it's going to be ribose as the sugar, and your choices of nitrogenous base are cytosine, adenine, guanine, and uracil instead of thymine. All right? So you don't have 20 beads to work with here like you do with proteins. You have 4 beads to work with for DNA, and you have 4 beads to work with for RNA. But, like I said before, you're stringing together millions of them. So imagine how many different possibilities there are if you have a choice of 4 at each position. Mathematically, it would be 4 raised to the million or more. That is a huge number, right? Effectively infinite. Okay, now those are the 3 components of a nucleotide. That's an individual monomer. But when you hook together multiple monomers, you form a polynucleotide. Well, the nitrogenous base, which is the only variable part, is what makes a nucleic acid, whether it's DNA or RNA, an informational molecule. Nucleic acids are informational molecules. They contain information, and the information is in the form of the sequence of nucleotides. And therefore, since the only variable part of nucleotides is the nitrogenous base, the real information of DNA and RNA is in the sequence of nitrogenous bases that are on those nucleotides. All right, because that's the only part that differs between nucleotides. When you build to preserve that, the integrity of that information, you know, the sequence is a code. That's the information. It's important that sequence be maintained. You don't want this thing to fall apart, because then you won't know what the code is, right? So if you build a polynucleotide to contain a code, you want to make sure that polynucleotide as a strand does not come apart. And therefore you use the strongest bonds you can, which are covalent bonds. All right? This is a similar thing to polypeptides if you think back to how those are built. Remember I said that involves only the amino and the carboxyl groups of the adjacent amino acids? Well, here the only thing involved in holding this polynucleotide together along its length are the sugars, the phosphate group of one nucleotide connected covalently to the sugar of the next nucleotide. And then its phosphate can be connected to the sugar of the next nucleotide, and so on. Those are covalent bonds and therefore very strong, and it keeps the code from being scrambled. Since it involves only the sugars and the phosphates, we call this whole chain of bonds the sugar phosphate backbone of the nucleic acid. But here's why it's kind of similar to proteins. Remember that the R groups of the amino acids weren't involved at all in keeping the polypeptide together, right? And the R groups were the variable parts of the amino acids. Similarly, the variable part of the nucleotide, which is the R, which is the nitrogenous base, is not at all involved in holding this thing together. Adjacent nitrogenous bases are not hooked together. They're just hanging off of the sugar phosphate backbone. But the specific sequence of those nitrogenous bases is the information that the nucleic acid is carrying. And that specific sequence tells the cell a specific thing. In the case of a gene, it tells the cell, this is the sequence of amino acids that you need to put together to build this polypeptide. Okay? So there, the nitrogenous bases do not hold the strand together. Well, a polynucleotide is a complete molecule, however long it is, however many nucleotides are hooked together. That's one complete molecule, really. And RNA, if you're building RNA, most RNA is a single polynucleotide. It's one strand. By the way, this reminds me that just like polypeptides, nucleic acids, since they can only be hooked together one way, sugar to phosphate, do not branch. They are just like polypeptides in that respect. It's one non-branching strand. Well, an RNA is typically just one polynucleotide, one strand. DNA is usually two strands, two polynucleotides, each of which is a molecule. So really, when we say one DNA, that's not really one molecule. One DNA is two polynucleotides, two strands, that are held together but not with chemical bonds. Yeah, that's what I'm just about to show you right here. Well, I'm not going to get into too much detail yet because we'll talk about that in unit 4. But yes, you're right that, well, let me just say it for everyone, that we have a DNA right here. And don't worry about this orange part. Just at the top, you have the general structure of a DNA. It's a double-stranded structure. I hesitate to say that a DNA is a molecule because I just told you it's really two molecules, two polynucleotides, each in a helical shape along its length. But there's two of those. So each of the blue ribbons is one sugar phosphate backbone of its own polynucleotide. And then you have hanging off of the backbone in each case the nitrogenous bases, A's, T's, C's, and G's. They're not holding them together along the length. They're just hanging off. But when you bring these two polynucleotides together, the nitrogenous bases at the same position but on opposite strands form hydrogen bonds, which are what the ellipses, the three dots, represent. And that's what holds the two strands together, but not very strongly. And that's important. I told you how important it is for it to be strong bonds holding the strand together, because otherwise you would lose the information. But it's also important for the bonds holding the two strands together to be weak and therefore easily broken. Because both of those two functions of DNA, transcription and replication, can't be done unless you can read the code, read the sequence. And you can't read the sequence unless you separate temporarily the two strands from each other so you can get in there and look at the nitrogenous nitrogenous base sequence. Okay? So hydrogen bonds are ideal because they can easily be broken temporarily, separate the two strands, read the sequence, and perform either replication, which is what's shown here, or transcription. And then when you're done with that process, let them go back together, which they will because of the reason they formed to begin with. Their hydrogen bonds are polar. Now, have I run out of time yet? Okay. The other thing I want to say about, we're going to study DNA in far more detail for the entire second half of the term, so I don't want to get ahead of myself, but while we're still looking at DNA here, let me show you another thing that is important about it. Each individual polynucleotide, either one in an RNA or two in a DNA, but just think of any polynucleotide in isolation. And in fact, just to make it easier, let me temporarily go back to 29. This is one polynucleotide. Any given single polynucleotide has a polarity to it, which I don't mean a charge at all. Polarity simply means that two ends are different in some respect. Any polynucleotide has a so-called 5' end and a so-called 3' end. The 3' and the 5' refer to the carbon in the sugar. Well, notice this phosphate, which is at the 5' end, is connected to the fifth carbon, this one right here. So one end of any polynucleotide will be the so-called 5' end. The other end involves this hydroxyl, which is connected to carbon 3 right here. That's the 3' end. That's how they got the names 5' and 3'. But those are two different ends with respect to each other. Okay? Now, DNA is made up of two polynucleotides, but the relationship between the two is called an anti-parallel arrangement. Which is more or less a head-to-foot arrangement, basically. What I mean here is that, as you can see here, one strand of the two will have 5' somewhere and 3' at the other end, but the other strand will have the 3', its own 3' situated next to the 5' of the other, and vice versa. Like this. Except it's twisted. So when you have both strands like that, and you twist it, what you really have is like a spiral staircase. The ribbons are the sugar phosphate backbones. That forms the structure of the staircase. But each step in the staircase is made up of a pair of nitrogenous bases. So each nitrogenous base is half of a step. Hydrogen bonded together with another half step. And so it's kind of like a twisted ladder or a spiral staircase over its length. Okay, that's anti-parallel, and that's enough information for this chapter, even though there's another slide. Some of these chapters have an ending slide that is just a summary table. I never read those to you, but that doesn't mean you don't have to know this. You already have been taught this. It's just a summary, so it's a good thing to look at if you're studying, but I've already mentioned it, so I don't read these to you. Yeah.
29. 29,
okay.
So I know that the phosphate groups end up like covalent bonds, but what about the sugar and the nitrous base?
Yes, that's covalent as well.
Okay.
This one right here, you mean, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's covalent.
Yeah.
And therefore, a nucleotide is well held together by itself, and then when you covalently bond it to another nucleotide, they stay together. That's what maintains the integrity of the information. Yes, except it's not a multimeric protein. It's a multimeric nucleic acid. But it's exactly analogous. You know, the two polypeptides, if let's say a multimeric protein is made out of two polypeptides, those two polypeptides are actually full molecules in their own right. But they're held together some way to make the complex that we call a multimeric protein. That's right, though. A DNA is made of two complete polynucleotides, so it's a multimeric nucleic acid. All right.